Hello, and welcome to Required Reading, the podcast that revisits the most impactful books from our childhood. I'm your host, Erin Bowles. I am a writer, actor, and comedian. Our guest today is Alex Brunkhorst. She is the author of two novels, The Gilded Life of Matilda Duplain, published by Mira, which is an imprint of HarperCollins, and The Mating Season, published by St. Martin's Press. Her novels have been translated into multiple languages. In a starred review, the Library Journal called The Gilded Life of Matilda Duplain reminiscent of the best of Daphne du Maurier, who we read Rebecca a couple months ago on this podcast, so that's fantastic. In addition to being a novelist, Alex is a very busy luxury real estate agent in Los Angeles. That's how we know each other. When not writing, reading, or selling real estate, Alex loves to travel. Every year, she tries to visit at least one country she's never been to before and is an avid baseball fan. Her favorite team is her hometown, Milwaukee Brewers. Hello!
Hi, Erin. Thank you so much for having me. I'm such a big fan of the podcast, as you know. I listen to every episode, usually when I'm taking my long walks. You're my companion.
Oh, that's so sweet. That means the world. We are in a book club together. Alex works with my boyfriend, and so we've talked a lot about books. And so I'm so excited because your pick for today was almost our first episode, was The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald. My guest for that very first episode said that and then said, actually, I want to do like a teen beach read that was very,
No
very personal
way.
to her. So I'm glad that this came all the way back around. I think this is going to be episode 70, maybe. So it's a nice round number. I'm so excited.
Wow. I was surprised when I saw that it was still available, actually.
Yeah.
I was shocked. And I was kind of debating about Gatsby and something completely different, which was Nancy Drew, because Nancy Drew was kind of my first introduction to reading. And so I was kind of going back and forth, but then I decided Gatsby, there's probably more to talk about. So I hope somebody else does Nancy.
At some point, we must. But we talked a tiny bit about this. It's the 100th anniversary of The Great Gatsby from 1925. 1925 was also the year that the US elected its first female governors. There were two in, I think, Wyoming and Texas.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, I think the first one, I think her name is Nellie Taylor Ross. I might be getting that completely wrong. But before we jump into Fitzgerald, what's your story with this book? How did it first come into your life?
So it first came into my life in high school, which is probably when a lot of people were introduced to it. And I don't remember what year it was in high school, but I want to say maybe like early high school, like sophomore year or something. And I remember it really resonated with me. I think, first of all, in high school, we so often read these books that are really tough to read, at least in my high school. Like we read so much Shakespeare, William Faulkner, Joseph Conrad. And I think that The Great Gatsby was kind of the first adult book that I remember feeling like, oh, I kind of get this. Like it was a straightforward read. His imagery is really easy to grasp. His sentence structure, I think, is very easy and almost like listening to a song. It's very melodic. And so I remember at the time just really identifying with it that way. In addition, I am from the Midwest. As you mentioned, I'm from Milwaukee. And Fitzgerald was from Minneapolis, I believe, or just outside Minneapolis. And I feel like there's a lot of themes to the book of kind of the a lot, I think a lot of the characters are actually from the Midwest, or Fitzgerald calls it the Middle West at that time. And they kind of migrate out east. And when I read it, I was in this place in my life where, first of all, I was always a very dreamy child and teenager. And so, kind of, that green light vision really spoke to me. And at that time, I was really eager to like move out east and go to school out east and just kind of start achieving, which in hindsight, I could have done just as well in the Midwest. But at that time in my life, I felt like I needed to get elsewhere to go do that. And so I think that the characters just really kind of stuck with me in that sense. And so that was definitely my first reading. Did you read it in high school as well?
No, this was my first
Oh,
reading of it. This is my very first
really?
time.
Oh, good.
Back when I started the podcast, which is almost 2 years ago that I started like working on it before I released the first couple episodes, I read the first 20 pages or so, but didn't get very far into it. So it was so nice to Finally dive in. It's so short. I don't know why this wasn't in my high school because we read Joseph Conrad. We got through Heart of Darkness. Why couldn't we have done this? But I was really it has such a big cultural place, deservedly so. And I always thought of it as a story of New York, of Long Island. I grew up outside DC, but really in the same way, dreamed of myself in New York. And one of the last pages, he says, "I see now that this has been a story of the West after all." And I was like, "Oh yeah, everyone gets that wrong, don't they?" I was so surprised that Daisy is from Louisville. Both my parents are from Kentucky, so that was I didn't know that was there. I didn't. There was so much that I didn't know of it, and I loved it. It was so incredible to me that it could be so good and so short and so artistically dense, not in a bad way, in just that like he's swinging for the fences, I guess, to bring baseball in. It's incredible. And I listened to a little bit of the audiobook of Matilda Duplain, and both of those are in first person. And I was so struck by, like, as an author, you have to do so much to establish the world of your characters. And then writing also in first person, everything has to be filtered through that character's perspective. And that is so. I mean, I think one of the sort of funnest tricks that this novel does is that it's. Gatsby is not the I in this. That's so surprising.
I
Gatsby
totally
arrives
agree.
at something like 27% of the way through. I did some math, which is so, a third of the way through. Oh my gosh, I loved it.
And I think you bring up a good point because I've read it 3 times now. So that was my first reading in high school. And my second reading was just after I finished my early drafts of The Gilded Life of Matilda Duplain. And at that time, I revisited it because a few of the agents I'd sent that to said, you know what, it has kind of a Gatsby-ish feel, which was a huge compliment. And I think that they meant it. A lot of the reason they said it, I think, is the narration. Because in both cases, you have a first-person narrator who's not of the world that he's stepping into. So, Nick is not of this world at all. And then somehow he ends up not only being kind of a glimpse into it, and I think we get a really objective view of the world from him just because he is kind of an interloper. But in addition, he ends up dramatically affecting the plot too. So it's this kind of interloper person that comes in, and you think, oh, all he's going to do is record basically what he's seen. But then through that ultimately ill-fated reintroduction that he makes to Daisy and Gatsby at his house, I feel like it was like a tea or lunch or something,
Yeah, I think
it ends up
so.
basically changing the events of the novel. So I think that that is really interesting how Fitzgerald kind of, had him be the narrator. And I had no idea that Gatsby came in that late when you think it's totally Gatsby's novel, but it's interesting that he wasn't introduced until like almost a third of the way through.
And he gets built up so much, both in a way that everyone's talking about his reputation and is he this or is he that, but also like the house itself has an essence. The imagery that you mentioned is just, I mean, gobsmacking in this book. That, the first glimpse we get of Gatsby is him just sort of standing there, kind of reveling in this world that he's created. And I like not having read it until now, there's a lot of like knowing around it in school of like, I know everyone says it's about the American dream and what does the Green Lantern symbolize and all of that. But I think I was, the thesis is so direct. And the copy I have has the final line of the book on the back about so we beat on boats against the current, borne ceaselessly into the past. I think I was so struck just about this sort of combination of hope and promise and want and enchantment and dreams. All of those words come up again and again and again, and wonder. And also about this sense that, like, well, none of that is ever fully attainable, or that we get there and it doesn't feel right. And combined with this sense of self and reinvention, I do like, I think the best novels are the ones that I don't have like fully coherent thoughts about. And I think this is one of them, you know? Because it's you're never going to get a definitive answer. It's I mean, you mentioned in your bio Daphne du Maurier, and I think her work is the stuff that you come back to and you're like, you're not looking for definitive answers. You're looking to read those lines and get something out of it every time.
I think that that's exactly why 100 years, I think it was like yesterday or the day before was the birthday, 100 years later, that's why Great Gatsby is still so relevant, because I feel like every reading of it, depending on where you are in your life or as a society, you're going to get different things out of it. Like, like I said, is my 16-year-old reading was very optimistic of, oh my gosh, this, Gatsby reinvented himself to create this glamorous world in order to get this woman. Now, again, my subsequent two, I've read it three times. So my subsequent two readings, I had very different views of it. Is it felt to me like this dream was doomed from the start. Now this reading, you see all those clues and images that Fitzgerald plants, like the early car crash, the word careless, which I think he uses often. And you see that this is not going to go, this is not going to go well. Like you kind of mentioned, is that sometimes the green light that we're all going after is not even what we should be trying to achieve, which I think one of the, I guess, most iconic parts of the book is the cover, with the eyes and the, the green tear, which I think I, again, was something that I'm sure at 16 I didn't pick up on, but now it's kind of like, okay, this green light, this dream actually was sadness or unachievable, or if you did achieve it, it was bound to let you down, I think.
I think when I was reading it that first time and that image is first introduced, I was sort of like struck by the lantern only lights up so much space that in the bit of illumination, it highlights all that it does not illuminate. And
That's a great point.
I think so much of this book is about limitation, is about that. I think I was so struck by it is a novel about dreams, and we have to keep persevering, not because there is something better guaranteed, but because what else is there? It's that or you lie down.
That's beautifully said.
I think that, like, I don't know, it's so incredibly vivid and charming. And I was looking into Fitzgerald and his life, and it's surprising how sort of autobiographical it is. Not in that Fitzgerald is Gatsby, but that Fitzgerald is very much Nick. He falls in love with this Chicago socialite, Ginevra King, who is his Daisy. Their family says you're too poor to marry her. So he joins World War I and is basically like, I hope I die out there, which I think Gatsby explicitly says. And then he goes to New York, he becomes an ad man, he's not successful, he comes home to St. Paul and basically says, like, I'm gonna lock myself in my home and try one last time to write my first novel, and then I'm done. And that's it. And he rewrites this novel, and it's This Side of Paradise, and it's an immediate success. And I think I needed to hear that, because everyone says, like, you're gonna succeed when you finally give up and when you're at your lowest. And I was like, well, fine,
True.
okay. And then it's immediately successful, and he and Zelda move to New York, and they have this insane hedonistic life. When Zelda gives birth to their first child, she apparently, like, comes out of the fog of anesthesia and says the beautiful little fool line about their daughter, and
Oh,
that is
really?
pretty
I didn't know
much.
that.
When people talk about Fitzgerald, and I just haven't looked into it, when people talk about Fitzgerald now, especially I think younger folks, they're just like, he stole it all from Zelda. Bad. And that's kind of the attitude. And maybe, I don't know, maybe he did. This at least seems very autobiographical in that he marries Zelda because they've kind of been together for long enough at this point. They get married and they're like, we're just kind of friends, we're just kind of hanging out. And there is a real life Gatsby when they moved to Long Island called Max Gerlach, who I did not look into, but the saying old sport constantly comes straight from him. And like the house parties, and he's a German heir of some sort. So all of that was really interesting, because I kept being like, old sport means something. It's gotta mean something. It's gotta No, it's just one of those real life details, which I love. Although there's a moment near the end where Gatsby says old sport to someone other than Nick. And I was gutted. I was like, oh, I thought that was a just like a secret friendship thing. And it's
Oh,
not.
I didn't even notice that.
Yeah, I think like I think maybe that's because I'm queer and I know a lot of people read this through a queer lens of like the Nick is like definitely in love with Gatsby. And I feel yes, I don't know in a romantic sense. I think he's there's so much about people as ideas here that Daisy is very much an idea. And I think Nick is just enchanted. That word shows up so much, enchantment.
I agree. And I never, in all of my years of loving Gatsby, looked into Fitzgerald, but I too found the Ginevra King information. And I thought it was really interesting because when I started to look at it, you're exactly right. There's a lot of parallels. And I think Ginevra's best friend was like an amateur golfer, even in Lake Forest, who served as the inspo for Jordan. And so I think that once I read that, then again, is I think that the novel even made more sense to me because I do feel like it felt very autobiographical, and it kind of made a lot of sense that there's kind of this really deep sense of longing throughout the novel, which I think that Fitzgerald had for Ginevra, even after, as I understand it, he married Zelda. Like, I think that Ginevra was still like the love of his life, and that he was probably heartbroken and probably, I would imagine, somewhat bitter by the fact that he w was kind of not able to marry her because I think her father arranged a marriage with like a polo player or something who clearly served
Someone,
as the
yeah.
inspiration for Tom. So it definitely did feel like it was very autobiographical. And I think that, as a writer, a lot of times when somebody is writing out of a specific emotion in your real life, I think it really seeps through into the novel. And I think that in this case is that's kind of why we understand Gatsby's longing so well. And even like the character of Daisy and Tom, and the fact that they kind of just leave after that whole tragedy happens. It's like they're just people who don't care what they left behind. And in the case again of Ginevra, you feel like it was her just kind of moving on and not caring what mess she left behind. So I definitely did read it very differently this time, having that background knowledge about the whole Fitzgerald King love affair, which again put it in different perspective. But again, the beauty of it is that like I take this novel very it's like a personal thing. But then you can also, I mean, its setting is the Jazz Age, and then we all know what happens after. So it's both kind of a very personal story of somebody's longing and kind of living in the past and pursuing an unattainable dream, and then what the tragedy that befalls him, but also just kind of as a country and society in that time, living in this kind of careless, reckless way, and then what happens directly after with the Great Depression, which Fitzgerald would have never known, obviously, when he was writing this book. So, again, I think it's just on so many levels, it's really interesting, which is, again, I think why it's kind of hung in there for 100 years. I'm sure people are still studying it right now in high school and in college lit classes, and people are still reading it.
I hope so. Yeah. Two little details that came up in my research. The same year that this was published, the first half of Mein Kampf was published. It's like, God,
Really?
what a yeah, what a setup. And then the
Yes.
other thing that I saw was I think Ginevra King's either marriage or engagement is announced like in the newspaper. And 3 days after Fitzgerald sees that, he tells the phrasing on Wikipedia was a little unclear, but it was that 3 days after he declares his love for Zelda, which I thought
Really?
was awful, but also
Awful.
very telling, you know?
Fascinating because I feel like now we know so much about Fitzgerald, but we know very little about Zelda and kind of how she fits into this whole thing. So, yeah.
And I really want to learn about Zelda in contrast to how much we know about Daisy, kind of as a cultural figure. And I think people tend to criticize Fitzgerald's writing of Daisy as that she is this, she just exists for men, or that she's kind of shallow. And it's like, those are not failings of Fitzgerald as a writer, those are purposeful choices, you know?
Exactly. Exactly, particularly in something like this, because like you pointed out, it's a really small type book with only a handful of characters. And so he doesn't have any time to just write kind of one of the main characters as a throwaway character. So you get the sense that everything that he was crafting in this book was very intentional. And the book that I read this time actually included a lot of the manuscript notes back and forth with his editor, et cetera. And it really was interesting how specific he went in various scenes and moving things around. It was clear he had a really good relationship with his editor because his editor did, give a lot of suggestions, which Fitzgerald took. And so again, I think that in something like this, you feel like he can't have any of those kind of throwaway scenes or characters, particularly not Daisy, who's incredibly important to the novel.
And it's sort of the crux of the novel, or one of them thematically, is that it's not that Fitzgerald doesn't have a sense of Zelda, it's that Gatsby doesn't. And that Gatsby's love of her, and I want to kind of talk a little bit about this idea of like she is the kind of prototypical, the one that got away. And the romance that was fated from the beginning and could never happen. But in those little bits where they're talking about their first meeting, and it's like filtered through Nick, but when Gatsby is telling Nick, his voice kind of takes the forefront. He doesn't say it explicitly, but in every other way he does. I loved Daisy's money. I went into Daisy's house and it was incredible, and she was casual about it. That was incredible. And I didn't realize that Gatsby's dad came in at the end. That was incredible to me. I just had no idea that that happened.
I forgot that that happened, actually. And I love that that happened. And I remember that was really interesting looking at Daisy through the lens of Gatsby, that was one of the things that he was really focused on. Again, was, I hate to say it, but her money. And that she just represented this person who at that time he couldn't get. And the fact that then he crafted his entire life to try to achieve that is really interesting. And again, in real life, that's the danger, I think, too, of living in the past, is if you're trying to recreate something in the past, particularly something like that, that sounds like it was a very brief relationship that they had at a moment in time, it's dangerous to live like that because ultimately the present is never going to live up to the past of what you think it can be. So I think that that just added to the tragedy of the whole thing is when you read that part, you thought to yourself, it wasn't like they had this tremendous love affair over years and that's what he was trying to recreate. I mean, he was probably, quite frankly, meant very little to Daisy at all. And so I think it's one of the tragedies of the novel. And when I read it again this time, that's why, again, the ending to me was particularly poignant because it's a tragic ending, but I feel like it almost couldn't have ended any other way because how else was it going to end? Gatsby wasn't going to just like ride off into the sunset or continue to have these parties at his big mansion. You kind of felt like how else could it have ended except for in a tragic way, right?
Yeah, because I think Gatsby, as an individual, probably never thought it through. I think he had so much on that seeing Daisy for the first time, and then everything will take care of itself. It's all about the attainment of wealth, and I think also that self-image of becoming the person that he always wanted to be. It's such a tragedy, but he was living. He wasn't living for Daisy. He was living for the idea of Daisy, for all that she symbolized to him and promised to him. And there's a line when he's talking about their initial romance where they say, like, Daisy had been with other guys and that increased her value to him. I was looking at it last night and it's the word specifically value. Like, she's
Value.
a stock. Yeah, that was so stunning. It was like, this is a prized possession, and I want to, which is sort of so fascinating, the character of Tom, because he is basically what Gatsby wants to be and doesn't like him. He's like, very clearly, this man is bad, to the point where this man is talking about eugenics. It's to have all of these things together, and Nick is there. It is this wonderful thing of just like, It's like a play. There are some great scenes, like the scene where sort of they all have it out in the hotel room that is punctuated so beautifully by Nick saying, "It's my birthday."
Yes.
Gutting. It's like a marble track. Like he places these marbles on their own track, and of course they're gonna smash together. You know, it's inevitable. It's incredible.
Exactly. And when you mentioned prized possession, I think that brought up something that I hadn't thought about before. Deezy's not a particularly likable character, but that's
Yeah.
part of the tragedy of her is I feel of her is I feel like for Tom, that's all she is a prized
Oh, yeah.
possession. She's like, one of his horses or something. Like it feels to me that like he doesn't even really care that she's around. Obviously, he's having an affair behind her back, but I think it's probably just the fact that like it was something else for him to acquire, almost probably out of boredom or whatever the case may be, or just social standing. Again, it's hard to feel badly for Daisy, but you do see how she ultimately, I don't think her life is going to end up very, very good either on the track that she's
No.
on, unless something dramatically changes.
Yeah. It's interesting that from the beginning, almost as soon as we meet Tom, we know that he is cheating on her. I think Jordan says, like, oh, well, everyone knows that he has a woman in New York. And it's, of course, a double standard that he gets angry that Daisy is having an affair. I think part of it is like Gatsby and I can't even remember Myrtle, the
Myrtle, I
woman
think is her
that
name. Yes.
that are so radically incomparable. Like this is a woman living over a garage. She is not, you know, the literal talk of the town. But that he's not okay with Daisy having an affair because I think Fitzgerald and Zelda were. I think they were like, we're friends, we're gonna be married, we're gonna have a life together, but like we don't love each other in like a romantic way. I think, like you said, it can just be continued to pull on these little threads, and it's such an insightful view of humanity. It's incredible.
But it is really interesting. And again, and you brought up play. And I think that is something that's interesting about this book is it does have a very play-like feel because it only takes place in a few different locations, really. If you think about it, it's like the plaza, Gatsby's house, Daisy's house, Nick's little cottage, and like the gas station, I guess, where Myrtle lives. But it's really only a handful of locations and a handful of characters, but it manages just to have such a huge impact, which again, I think is one of the really special things about the novel, and in its length. I mean, again, you're right. It's a very, I had forgotten too how short it was. Because when I went to revisit it, I thought, oh my gosh, I have to read this whole book. And it literally took me like 2 days to read because it was such a great read, and it's so short, but again, it really manages to make you think after you've read it for sure. And it's interesting. So I have a question for you. So randomly, about 2 months ago, I had written, which I totally forgot, on LitHub, an article about Fitzgerald and the Great Gatsby. I completely forgot that I wrote it. It was forever ago now, probably when Matilda came out, so maybe 10 years ago. So somebody reached out to me. His name was Sean, and I'm probably going to butcher his last name, but I think it's Drujani. And he brought up something really interesting about Nick ending up directly next to Gatsby's big house. And he said, do you think that Gatsby arranged for Nick to end up in that cottage? Because what is the coincidence that Daisy, I think Daisy's Nick's like second cousin once removed or something, they're somehow related, would end up directly next to Gatsby. And so he brought that up as an idea, and I thought it was kind of interesting because it feels like Fitzgerald is not one for coincidences, but that does feel like a coincidence that somehow Nick ended up almost on Gatsby's estate.
Like on his lawn.
And as long, exactly.
That's really interesting, and I hadn't thought of that. And I think I was sort of struck by, like, and maybe this is a time difference or like era difference. When Nick is like setting up the cottage, he's talking about how, you know, it's small, it's nothing like Gatsby's. He does have like a Finnish woman maid. I was like,
I
well,
noticed
hold on now. I'm not
that.
having a maid. Hold on. But I think, I don't know, because I don't know if Gatsby, you know, knows that he's coming in to town. I want to know so much more about like Gatsby's business and all of these mysterious phone calls he's getting. But I think It's what I'm stuck on is that Gatsby has this gigantic estate on, like, it's odd that a little cottage is next to it. Like, is this the
That's another
lesser
good
of the
point.
islands? Is that how we understand it to be? Then is like, is it beneficial not only that it's across from Daisy, but that it's a little cheaper? And
Good
ultimately,
question.
like, Gatsby is, I mean, a self-made man. Yeah, he
Yes.
probably still likes a bargain. I
I
don't know. That's fascinating. Because, like,
know
you're
when
right.
he
He
because when he
doesn't seem
brought it
like one for
up.
coincidences. Yeah.
No, and when he brought it up, I thought, you know, that's a really interesting idea. And he said maybe it's even a cottage on Gatsby's estate or something, because it's to your point, is generally how things are set up is there wouldn't be like, you know, an 800 square foot bungalow right next to what
Right.
looks like a 10,000 square foot mansion. So I guess it's just something to think about, which maybe people have written about it before, but I didn't. Was definitely interesting because I do think that there is such intention in kind of the real estate of it all, which of course I
Yeah.
love, of, you know, Daisy being on kind of the high-end old money section, and then Gatsby, you're right, purchasing this house that you envision probably being, obviously it was very over the top, but probably like slightly less desirable, you know, section, or else he probably would have moved to the old money section to be
Right.
closer to Daisy. And then there's just this random cottage. And
Yeah.
I agree with your point about Gatsby and the business dealings, because he's always having these mysterious long distance
Yeah.
calls, etc. And, you know, I think that Nick does give kind of some explanation as to what he does, but it's still all kind of nefarious, and we don't ever quite understand, which was probably intentional on Fitzgerald's part. I think we just kind of know it's probably on the wrong side of the law somehow.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that Nick is vaguely in stocks, which feels so
Yeah.
heavy hanging over 29 and the
That's
stock market
true.
crash. But I'm still thinking about that question of was it set up? And I think there's a line of Nick is like gonna have a roommate and then the roommate never shows up.
That's right. I forgot about that mysterious roommate too. But that also feels like
Yeah.
a weird coincidence, right? But he
Yeah.
happens to live next door to Gatsby. He's supposed to be living with the roommate. I forgot about that. And then the roommate never shows up. And then it seems like very quickly Gatsby introduces himself to Nick, right? So, and that's, I guess, another question mark is it feels to me like he has to know that Nick has some connection to Daisy. Because
Yeah.
very early on, it seems like, I mean, you know, again, as you pointed out, it's 27% through, but it feels like there's a lot of times you never meet your neighbor, or like in that case too,
Yeah.
if there's a, you know, if there's someone that's relatively insignificant who's living in a cottage next to you, it would seem that you may never meet him. So that's it's I
Yeah.
guess we should research further.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting because I don't know. Every time I want to be like, well, I don't know if Gatsby would do that much research. He's like, no, he found Daisy in all the country. He
Totally.
found Daisy and
He
found the
found
house across
Daisy.
the. And so then I'm thinking about, we talked a little bit because our book club had read All Fours and we talked about this couple in it. What if they were like purposefully pulling the wool over the main character's eyes? And so I'm sort of on the same kind of mental tangent here of, well, if Nick is supposed to have a roommate and then the roommate never shows up, Nick is extra isolated and so maybe extra looking for companionship.
True.
And then I think the most interesting thing about Gatsby is that when he is introduced, Nick is just talking to a guy at the party and suddenly it is Gatsby. And
Yes.
Gatsby talks about like he asks like, "What do you think of me, Nick? Like, what is your idea of me?" And his first line is, "Your face is familiar. Weren't you in the third
Oh.
division during the war? I knew I'd seen you somewhere before," which I thought of
Interesting.
like I'm always trying to think like, how do I network at parties? How do I, automatically endear me to people so that they'll one day give me something? And I think it's such a wonderful thing to be like, you were memorable and you
Yes,
stuck with me. And so
true.
combining that with like with him seeing him just on the lawn, you want to think about like Gatsby is like purposefully placing himself in ways that Nick can feel like he discovers him, you know?
Yes, I totally agree. That's which again, I think is interesting, and it kind of plays to the point of you wonder how much Gatsby has pulled the strings behind Nick being there, particularly because it does feel like he's lived such a purposeful life to get to his single goal of Daisy. So it would seem like he's been able to achieve everything and have these parties and have this social life and everything imaginable, that it would seem like it's probably pretty easy to get into the orbit of somebody that he feels like could introduce him. Again, this was before the age of social media, where now it's like one click to somebody who can introduce you to someone, so it is more difficult at that time, granted, but it kind of gave me a lot to think about when I got that email, because it was something that I hadn't thought about before,
I
for
love that.
sure.
It feels
And
like such a good English class discussion
yes,
question to throw in. Yeah, I
I
love.
know. That's why too, is so many of these books, like even on your podcast, the ones that I kind of revisit or maybe have never read, and you're talking about them, like I feel like the other day I listened to your podcast on The Scarlet Letter, which I definitely had read in high school, but I don't remember our discussion of it at all. And you think, oh, I wish I could sit in a class, and which is kind of what
Yes.
we're doing, and like revisit this right now, because it would be so much more meaningful to me than feeling like when I was, 15, 16, 17, and it's homework and you're trying to get through it. And, whereas again, now it feels like you have such a different perspective. And, we're lucky because we have Wikipedia and we have, a lot of resources online, but it's still different than like having the discussion that you and I are having right now. To be able to kind of revisit these books. So again, I'm so appreciative of your podcast, because even when I have read the book, it makes me think about it completely differently. And if it's a book that I haven't read, I suddenly think, oh, I've got to read that book and then listen to the podcast again after.
Oh, thank you. I do like, I wish that all of the books that you read in high school are like this, that are this short, like you said at the beginning, that have this very easily digestible language, that are part of the past, but still present enough to feel accessible. Because when we did our Huck Finn episode, that was a big question that I kept coming back to, of like, why are we teaching this in school? Like, what are we hoping the kids, and that was in Scarlet Letter as well, like, what are we hoping our kids take away from this? And the answer that my guest Niles Abston had in Huck Finn was like, kids might never like read again. This might be the only chance in their life. They might not go to college. They might not become readers in their spare time. So let's get the good stuff in while we can. So I don't know. I see that, and I also like that text is like not great. Let's
And I mean, Scarlet Letter, I remember you discussing that with the guest, is, and I don't know if, are they still teaching Scarlet Letter in high schools, I
I
wonder,
don't
or
know. I kind of hope not.
because I wonder if they are, I wonder if they're still teaching that. And I remember you saying that, again, I haven't read it in so long, that book was kind of another tough one to kind of get through. And I think that the beauty of Gatsby, again, is in those high school years, you really want to kind of reel people into reading, because if you're introducing them to books that are not fun to read or that they don't understand, I mean, particularly now, because I think there's fewer and fewer readers, is I think that you could kind of lose them at that point. Whereas if you do introduce
Definitely.
them to books that they can, take the themes and maybe apply them to their own lives, or that feel like, oh, they're short and I accomplished something by getting through this and understanding it, I think it really gives a very different view towards reading. And again, I mean, back to, I know it's off topic, but back to Nancy Drew, is for me, that was why I fell in love with reading, is that they were short books. I remember, like, I would go to the mall with my mom, and she would allow me to get like one or two Nancy Drews, and like maybe in a weekend or something. And I would go in my room and close my door and just like delve right into them. And I think that something like that did ultimately sow the seed for me as still being a huge reader. So I think that it is important that we teach books that I think kids actually enjoy and can understand, and that don't feel like they're only just homework. Or because, again, I mean, we even see it with book club. I think with our book club, is if it's a book that's kind of an easy read, and we in a good conversation piece, like we really enjoy it. And then there's some of those books that I can tell that we all come in and we're like, oh, we struggled with this. It took us really long to read it. We didn't identify with it. So then you kind of, I think, lose the momentum in reading.
I think the critical piece is finding characters that you identify with and a world that you are engaged in, that you want to be a part of. Because I think with Scarlet Letter, like I loved when I was in, I didn't read Scarlet Letter when I was in high school, but I loved that my English class and my history class wanted to overlap. They wanted, if you're learning about something in history, we want you to be reading something that's either from that period or about that period. I think that's how things
Great.
should be taught. But I think if you're learning about the Salem witch trials, I think the Crucible is so much better because it's about then and it's about the 50s. It's about what was current and it's a play. And I think that is so much like, even though I think Shakespeare is not the starting point, we want kids, maybe that's, AP senior language English class, work up to that. Because we were reading Shakespeare in seventh grade and I loved it. And everyone else hated it, justifiably so. But I think a play is a great way to get people engaged in it because you're participating in it. So I think this is great because even though these kids aren't living on Long Island or something, maybe they are, there is so much wonder and enchantment and dreams and these volatile relationships. And even though these characters are in the 30s, they're still stuck on, the first loves from when they're 17 and 18. I think it's so applicable to all of that. And it's the thing of like, I want to know who Gatsby is, and I want to go to this party at least. I think that is, it's really perfect for high schoolers to sink their teeth into.
Definitely, definitely. No, I mean, I agree, is that you do at least you want to go to the parties, right? And so he manages to, but it's not like a thriller or a mystery, but there's suspense in it because you know something's going to happen and you want to know what happens, like when you said when all these marbles collide, what's going to happen. So I agree. And again, I just being able to read it again has just been such a treat for me because it is one of those books. I think it's probably the only book that I've read three times. And I enjoyed it as much now as I did when I first read it. And so I'm so happy that I chose it because, like I said, I was shocked that it was still available. And now I know the backstory of why it is.
I've just been waiting for it for someone because it's so small and so iconic. I've been waiting for someone to pick it. When you are a high school English teacher, you're competing against so much. And I mean technology and just life as a teen, but also like you got calculus homework and you've got to learn the periodic table of elements. So I think this is just a perfect book.
I know. Well, and I think too is that what was totally different than when I grew up is that now, again, attention spans are getting so much shorter too. So I feel like something like this is like a good size book for someone who, again, it's just, I think our brains are just being rewired. I know mine is to just not, if I see something that's too meaty and too big, even me being a big reader, I tend to not pick it up. Like I definitely gravitate towards books that like I can read in like a week or two, as opposed to something that right away feels so daunting. I think that that also again makes Gatsby even more relevant today compared to some of these other books that I think a lot of people would have a hard time getting through right now. I know I would.
Definitely. Yeah, it's there's so much competing for your attention and life feels like it moves so fast. So sitting down and taking some time, I think, feels probably daunting, maybe.
I
I don't know.
know,
That's
or
certainly
at least
not.
like a luxury.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, there's just this one line that I had. I love when you're reading something and you're like, oh, that sentence, that's the book. That's the theme right there. I got it. I feel like I'm perpetually like getting ready to write an essay in high school. I'm always like highlighting lines of like, we'll come back to this one and I'll put this one in the third paragraph. But there's he must have felt that he had lost the old warm world, paid a high price for living too long with a single dream.
I feel like that does encapsulate the book, right? I guess it's a life lesson. Is that I think so many of us end up pursuing one dream, whatever it is, like a love interest or a job or like a creative profession or whatever it is. And it's hard to know kind of when to let go of that dream and when to abandon it and when to keep holding on to it. And I think that's probably one of the hardest things, at least in my life. you know, looking back, is like, when do you keep pushing through and when do you think that like it's maybe something not pursuing? So again, I think that line is so good. It talks about Gatsby, but I think that it talks about just life.
Yeah, and that is really interesting because it's in those moments that are, you know, the most heartbreaking. We're like, no one's showing up for his funeral.
I
You know,
know.
this
I know. I
it's
was
so hard.
devastated. I know. When nobody showed up for his funeral, I was so upset. Like all over again this time around.
Yeah. But like you
It was.
said, it is sort of like, how could it be anything else? That is
Yes.
sort of the life he made for himself.
Totally. Totally. No, I mean, it seems inevitable, but when it's happening, again, I think it was very heartbreaking to me.
Yeah. So I think maybe it's at the end of chapter 5, but there's a moment where, because reading it, I was like, what's the green light? That's the question everyone asks. So there's a moment where it's sort of like, oh, here he says it. It's why are we spending so much? It's right here. So possibly it had occurred to him that the colossal significance of that light had now vanished forever. Compared to the great distance that had separated him from Daisy, it had seemed very near to her, almost touching her. Now it was again a green light on a dock. His count of enchanted objects had diminished by one. I thought that was incredible. Enchanted objects.
That was definitely a line that I had highlighted too. And I remember, I mean, first of all, when I started reading the book, I was highlighting everything. I was like, I just highlight this, and then I thought to myself, I've got to stop highlighting. But so by the end, I was highlighting less, but I definitely highlighted that line. I mean, it's just such a beautiful line. And again, it just like it encapsulates not only the book, but I think the characters and real life, which is why we're talking about this book, I think, 100 years
Yeah,
later.
for sure.
To be able to revisit these books and then hear them through a different lens. Like, even I remember when you were talking about, speaking of Dickens, A Christmas Carol on your podcast, and like you gave all the background on him and his family. I mean, it's so interesting to, again, be able to hear that right now. And even if it's a book I haven't read, it's still interesting to hear the background on it. So
Yeah.
keep up the good work. I love it. You have a
Thank
lot of
you.
fans.
Thank you. I know at one point I was doing less of the history stuff in the episodes, and my dad was like, it's lacking. I need that part back. Do more of
Yes.
that. So I said, okay, got it, got it. Because I do really like those parts. It's I love research. I love research.
Well, you did a great job here because, again, I think that Gatsby is better understood through what Fitzgerald was going through right before and after writing it, and during writing it. So, I definitely think that, again, I'm hoping that the 100-year birthday makes people read the book again. And see it through kind of a different lens or a current lens.
Yeah. Well, I think it's time for the final question. Would you consider it required reading?
I definitely would. I definitely
Me
would.
too.
I think everybody should read it. How about you?
Oh, yes, without a doubt. Absolutely. It's one of those that, like, even just if not for the cultural significance, the writing is just so good.
Agree.
Absolutely. Well, we're rounding out. Is there anything you would like to plug? Anywhere you'd like to be found, if any? Obviously, check out The Gilded Life of Matilda Duplain.
Yes, which you can buy on Amazon. So I think that would be my big plug. And it does have like some Gatsby elements to it. So,
Definitely.
and again, thank you so much for having me, Erin. It's always good to see you. And
Thank
I
you.
will read The Awakening before your next podcast.
Oh, yes. Okay, well then I'm going to stop the recording. Thanks so much to Alex. Next week we are doing The Awakening by Kate Chopin, excuse me. And you can support the podcast at buymeacoffee.com/required reading. And you can follow me everywhere at Erin R. Bowles. And I love to hear feedback, comments, all that. Thank you so much. Goodbye.